Good morning, everyone. I want to thank everybody for joining us for the third leg of our legal holiday Shiurim series. I want to once again thank all of our Shiur sponsors, quickly to Jennifer and Ronnie Aronoff, Sheila and Ronnie Appel, Amy and Daniel Gibber, Dina and Saul Kasvitz, in commemoration of the Yartzeit of Dina's father, Avi Blumenfeld, Avram Yosef and Yisrael Shalom, Olav HaShalom, Mindy and Henry Orlinsky, Tzivi and Yossi Rubin, in commemoration of the first Yartzeit of Yossi's mother, Bela Bas Yosef, Yehuda Zichrono Levracha, Nechama and Danny Sachs, Naomi and Kenny Schiff, Lonnie and Jimmy Tenenbaum, Aviva and Avi Vogel. Thank you to all of our sponsors. So I had the opportunity over the course of the series to introduce Rabbi Aryeh Leibowitz, Rabbi Shai Shachter, and now I have the immense zechus to introduce Rabbi Daniel Stein, who will be giving shiur this morning. I've mentioned over the course of this series and introducing other guest speakers that we are zochah to have here in B'nai Asherin. In our kahila, we are almost privileged to take for granted the fact that we frequently have the opportunity to hear from some of the greatest Talmidei Chachamim, Malamdei Torah, Marbitzei Torah, that are out there, that really we have to offer. And it's something that perhaps we at times take for granted, but every now and then we should stop to appreciate. And it is a tremendous zechus to have Rav Daniel Stein among us this morning, who is an incredible Marbitz Torah through his work giving shiur in YU, through his work in the city, his shul on the Upper West Side, and also through what Ritz Bachrim know as the fourth year Halacha L'Maisa program, which is what Rav Stein runs as well. I remember my first year in Yeshiva University, Rav Stein was giving a chabura in the 39 Malachos of Hilchos Shabbos in the annex to what is now known as the Old Beis Medrash. Back then, it was just known as the Beis Medrash. And it was recommended to me by a chaver of mine, Rabbi Yosef Bronstein. And I remember that while I didn't end up attending live, I ended up getting all the recordings afterwards, which is, I guess, a feature of contemporary Torah learning and Torah life. And I just remember being mesmerized by not just the breadth and scope of Rav Stein's of Torah knowledge, but also just the clarity and lucidity of presentation, and particularly the way Rav Stein is capable of taking a sugya and bringing it from its original sources in the Gemara and the Rishonim, all the way through the Shulchan Aruch, the Nosa Kelim, and the contemporary poskim. One gets a real palpable sense of Mesorah and the transmission of Halacha as it's existed through the millennia, the centuries, and bringing us all the way up to contemporary times. So Rav Stein is somebody who is an active part in the transmission of that Mesorah. And in teaching Halacha, he not only gives you a sense of what the Halacha is, but a real palpable sense of the Mesorah that is being transmitted to you. It is a wonderful zechus for us this morning to hear from Rav Daniel Stein.
It's always a pleasure and an honor to be able to learn with the Beis Medrash Chevra on a Sunday or holiday morning and spend a little time with one of my role models, with Henry, and it's always in awe of his askanus in the community and beyond within Yeshiva. Mm-hmm. And we all have a tremendous sense of gratitude towards him for all that he does for the community at large. It's also a particular, always a pleasure for me to be able to come to a shul where the whole rabbinic team now is chaverim and contemporaries, and nice. Sometimes the rabbonis can be a lonely place, and it's nice to know that you have people who one can talk over shilas to, and you know, to discuss personal issues with the entire rabbinic team, Rabbi Shreyer, Rabbi Zatz, our close yedidim and friends and confidants. And we wish Rabbi Shreyer much hatzlacha here in his new tenure, and it's a pleasure to be able to wish you in person and within the shul itself. I'm sure the shul recognizes how lucky they are to have you at the helm. The end of the year, or the beginning of the year, where we find ourselves, January 1st, January 2nd, of course, right before the end of the year, most of us received a flurry of solicitations from charitable organizations asking us to give money and to maximize our tax benefits and deductions that a person can, you know, can gain right towards the end of the year. So I wanted to take a moment back to reflect on the whole issue of paying taxes in general, for or against, you know, that whole issue. I told someone before, you could have evaded the shiur. Once you come to the shiur, now you might be stuck. But what is the issue of paying taxes in general? Where does it come from? And, you know, to what extent, you know, what is the basis for perhaps in Halacha? So the Gemara tells us in the Sefer Nedarim, it's really a Mishnah, that, of course, typically if a person takes a neder, he has to fulfill that which he accepted upon himself to do. If he takes a vow, he has to follow through on that vow. It's prohibition not to do so. However, there are certain rare instances where a person can take a vow and not follow through on that which he said. For example, the Mishnah says, if a person is being threatened and his life is in danger, and the only way he can extricate himself from the situation is to take a neder that, oh, yes, I'll do whatever you ask, even though he took such a neder, he doesn't have to follow through with the neder because he only obviously did so under duress in order to save his life. So in those circumstances, you're not obligated to follow through with the neder. Another situation the Mishnah brings up in that context is if a person takes a neder to avoid the tax man. He's coming to collect the taxes, and a person says, yeah, I'll pay you tomorrow. I'll take a neder to that effect. He doesn't have to follow through on that neder. So the Gemara quotes in the name of Shmuel, who asks, how could that be? Well, you're obligated to pay taxes by virtue of Dina de Malchusa Dina. The law of the land is considered to be the law, and that's acceptable in Halacha too. So how could it be you can take a false neder, or take a neder, not fall through on the neder, in order to evade the taxman? So the Gemara there explains that it's because we're talking about a specific situation where the person who imposed the tax is not the legitimate monarch. He's a tyrant, a pirate, some sort of despot, but not a person with a legitimate claim to the malchus. Or the tax that he imposed is not a fair tax. It doesn't apply equally across the board. It's targeted towards one individual, perhaps a group of individuals, one specific community or demographic, but it does not apply equally across the board, in which case it's not a fair tax, and therefore not legitimate in the eyes of Halacha either, and therefore Dina de Malchusa Dina would not apply, and that's why, in that limited circumstance, you could take a nether to you're going to pay, and then, not follow through on the nether. The implication, of course, of the Gemara is that absent those extenuating circumstances, if it would be a legitimate monarch, or the tax imposed would be a fair tax, of course, one would be obligated. The Rama makes this point in Hilchos Mazik that if the legitimate monarch, the tax that was imposed is a fair tax, one would be obligated to pay taxes by virtue of Dina de Malchusa Dina. But a lot of our taxes are not a standardized tax, right? The Gemara says if it's a fair tax, it's imposed on everyone equally. So that would mean like the Machzis HaShekel, right? Usher lo yarbe, hadal lo yamit. The poor man doesn't give any less, the rich man doesn't give any more. It's a standardized tax, that's fair. What about if it's a progressive tax, where there's a graduated schedule depending on how much money you make with different brackets? So is that fair? Maybe that's not fair. Maybe the halakha doesn't recognize that as being a fair way of distributing taxes. So Rav Zevin, was of course the first editor of the Encyclopedia Talmudis, but more famous for many of his other svarim, or halakha, the Tarvu Mo'adim. So one of his svarim, Al-Kumish, called the Tarvu Mo'adim, a Pashas Kisisa, he notes that we find a precedent for this in halakha too, of a progressive tax. Where? Because the Mishnah says Mesechus Peah. The first Mishnah says, all right, Eilu Dvarim Shein Lahem Shear, some of the things that have no shear is Peah. No amount. That's the corner of the field that has to be left aside for the poor people. However, the Mishnah says, even though Meikra Adin, Midai Raisa, there is no shear, Ein Peresim LePeah Pachos Mishishim. You shouldn't give less than 1/60th. 1/60th is the shear for Peah. But then, the Mishnah is of Hakor Lefi Gadol Hasada. Everything depends on how big the field is. Everything depends on how big the field is. So, what does that concluding phrase mean? Hakor Lefi Gadol Hasada. I presume the Pashup shot is that what that means is if you have a field that's so big, 1/60th is going to be whatever 1/60th. If you have a larger field, 1/60th is going to be a larger amount because the field itself is larger. That's how percentages work. However, that can't be. How can it be? The Mishnah is coming to explain something that's just elementary arithmetic and how you apply percentages, right? And the Mishnah is just following through and explaining for us if you have a small field, a larger field, the amounts are going to be different because percentages change by depending on how much capital you're splitting up, how much of the field is. It can't be. So Rav Zevin says, no, what it means is that if there's a bigger field, the expectation is you'll give a bigger percentage. A small field is enough of 1/60th. A big field, how colorful you go to us, other you should give, meaning even on a minimal level, the basement, the floor should be a higher percentage. So Rabbi Zevin there writes, you see from here that in halacha, we have a precedent for a progressive tax, for something that depends on how much money a person makes. We have it in tzedakah in general, right? The standard amount, if a person can't afford it, is a miser, but then Gemara says if you can afford it, you can give up to a fifth. up to a fifth of what you have. A fifth, more than a fifth, 20% is not recommended. Maybe you yourself will become poor. You need help from the community. However, the price can rise if a person, let's say, makes, I mean, it's shown by all of us, make a few billion dollars a year. So then to give 20%, I guess, is a lot. It is. It's a lot of money, but it's not a big, per, you know, in terms of how much the person will have to live on if you make, you know, whatever, $5 billion and you could have, you know, $3 billion to live on would also be okay. So if you give away 40%, also wouldn't be, it's unheard of, but it wouldn't be crazy. In the eyes of halacha, so a person could even give more than that. So in halacha too, we have that the standard, even in terms of percentages, is not the same that's applied for different people at different ends of the income scale. So to have a progressive tax, also in the eyes of halacha, is a fair tax. It doesn't have to be standardized, like machzis hashekel, everyone gives the exact same amount. That would also be a fair tax, and dina malchus adina should apply. But what is dina malchus adina, in order to understand, you know, how it's, the applications of it, you know, we have to understand what is it predicated upon? What is the reason that dina malchus adina, and we have here a big machlekes harishonim. The Meiri in his commentary Masechta the Sedarim, that Mishnah explains, that the reason why Dina the Malchus Adina exists is because of the Parshas HaMelech. This is some of the privileges of the monarch, is he has the right to establish taxes. And say for Shmuel, when the Jewish people asked for a king, first time, so the Navi discourages them. Shmuel Navi discourages them from having a king. So it's a discussion was the you know, having a king like all the other nations, was that a concession, or was that an ideal that we should have a king? So Shmuel HaNavi discourages the people from wanting to have a king, and he explains, do you understand what you're asking for? He said he can confiscate your property at his, you know, at will, at his discretion. He can confiscate your property. Are you sure you want that? And then he gave mentions a few other things to discourage him from having a king. So Gemara in Sanhedrin, the Chaf, has a machlekes. All the things that Shmuel Navi told him, beware of having a king because he can do X, Y, or Z. Is the king actually allowed to do that? Or was Shmuel Navi just coming to Kedeva Ayimalein? He was coming to scare them, to discourage them from having a king because he could abuse his power and do X, Y, or Z. But he really is not allowed to do that halachically. That's a machlekes in the Gemara. So the Meiri assumes that we paskin, we conclude, no, koha amar parshas melech, Melech Mutterboy, whatever is mentioned by Shmuel HaNavi, the king is permitted to do it. And one of the things that the king is permitted to do, as mentioned by Shmuel HaNavi, is to levy and collect taxes, to confiscate property. So that's one of the privileges of the king, is that he has the right to levy taxes. And Meiri assumes, not all Rishonim agree, that this applies whether we're discussing a Jewish monarch or a non-Jewish monarch. Malchei Umos HaOlam all have these same privileges, and abilities, al-pi halakha, to, it's not wrong for them to do it, to levy taxes and to collect those taxes, assuming, right, that it's done fairly or equitably and not in a targeted fashion. All of those things would be within the purview, within the range of the privileges of the king. Why does the king have these privileges? So Rashbam explains in Baba Basra, the Rambam has the same thing with regards to his comment on taxes in Pevel Mazik. That it's because whoever lives in a certain region, in a certain country, certain state, you know, that's ruled by this monarch, is by default, implicitly, tacitly accepting upon themselves all of the rules that are imposed by this monarch. And they agree to live, you know, abiding by those rules that are imposed. Now, it's true. Now we take for granted we can move from place to place and the liberty, right, to travel around. In those days, you were kind of stuck where you were born. You didn't have the ability, or in, you know, previous generation, you had the ability to travel from place to place. So what choice did I have other than to live here? But at the same time, it could be that simply by living there, you know, even if you had no other choice, by default, the person automatically accepts, you know, upon themselves the obligations of the ruling monarch, who has the ability to impose these kinds of obligations. And they actually have a responsibility to impose rules and obligations. Right? One of the Sheva Mitzvahs B'nai Noach is dinim, is laws. What is meant by laws? What is meant by dinim? So Rambam writes in Hilchos Melachim that what is meant by dinim is that the B'nai Noach have an obligation to set up a system of justice and to create laws and to carry out those laws and to enforce those laws, to create, you know, the rule. The law and order is what the mitzvah of dinim is all about. In fact, that's why the Rambam says that Shimon and Levi were justified in killing Shem, and not only Shem, for kidnapping and raping Dina, but they were entitled to kill out the entire city, all of the people of Shechem. Why? They didn't do anything wrong. So Ram says, no, what they did wrong was they didn't kidnap and rape Dina. That was Shechem himself. Why did they kill out the whole town? So Ramban says, because they were all corrupt and the whole society deserved to die anyway. Okay. But there are, that's Ramban and Parash Vayishlach. However, the Rambam disagrees. The Rambam says, no, it's because they harbored a criminal. They had him in there and they didn't enforce the rule of law. They didn't create a system of justice in their society. And that's a violation of dinim. That itself is wrong. It's to have a corrupt society without laws, without rules, is itself wrong. So part of the mitzvah of dinim is to create, rules and obligations and to enforce them. And therefore, Rashi writes in the Masechta Gittin, I think all these Rishonim are driving at the same thing. Rashi writes in the Masechta Gittin, the Dina de Mahusa Dina is a function of Dinim, the mitzvah of Dinim, that the Bnei Noach who run a society have the obligation to create law and order as part of, what an ethical and moral society, even if it's, the level of Shem Mitzvah, Bnei Noach, it's obvious that we need that in order to function. And therefore, Dina de Mahusa Dina is a function of that, is an outgrowth of that, kind of like the Parshas HaMelech. If you phrase it this way, you understand it in this, based on this kind of framework, so then we understand why that wouldn't be limited to necessarily a monarch in the traditional sense, but a democratically elected government would also have these same kinds of obligations in the midst of dinim, and one shouldn't really distinguish in the parish of Dina de Mahusa Dina, whether we're discussing a king or discussing a government, whatever is the ruling entity has an obligation to establish these rules, create a social order, and to enforce these rules in a fair, right, and judicious fashion. It is odd, perhaps at first, when I hear the notion that the Parshas HaMelech, the dinim of the king, should apply bein to Malchei Yisrael, bein to Malchei Umos HaElam. Why should the halachos of the Jewish king and the privileges he enjoys be extended to Malchei Umos HaElam? Shmuel HaNavi was describing Jewish kings. Why should that necessarily extend to Malchei Umos HaElam? However, if you think about it more, I don't think it's so surprising at all. We had in last week's parasha, Moshe and Aaron are commanded to go to Paro to demand that Paro will liberate the Jews. So, by Tzavon El Paro, the Melech Mitzrayim Lema, right? So the Rashi there writes, when HaKadosh Baruch Hu told Moshe and Aaron to go to Paro, they told him, Lachuk Lo Kovid, treat him with respect. If you go to Paro, treat him with respect. And similarly, when Moshe greets Paro prior to the Makkah of Dom, he finds him on the riverbank. The pasuk says, "V'nitzav v'krosai." He was standing, waiting for him. So the Gemara in Masechta Zevachim quotes from Reish Lakish, who has the opinion, "V'nitzav." This is machlokes in the Gemara, but Reish Lakish's opinion is "V'nitzav v'krosai." He was standing, waiting his turn, waiting to be called in. He was in the office, he made an appointment, and he was waiting to meet with Paro. He didn't barge in. Sometimes, we get the impression Moshe Rabbeinu barges into the palace. No, he made an appointment, and he waited his turn, and then he greeted Paro, and he treated him with respect. And we find the parashas Miketz too, right? Yosef, before he greets Paro for the first time, the pasuk says, "Vaygalech vaychalech simloisef." He took a haircut, and he changed his clothing, again, to show proper cover the malchus. Well, familiar, the Gemara in Brachos that says, if a person meets Malchei Umos HaElam, he makes a bracha, baruch shenasa mikvodei, the boss of Adam. Blessed are Kadosh Baruch Hu, who bestowed honor upon flesh and blood. Shenasan mikvaydai lebasar v'dam. Fantastic little Rosh HaTevis. Shenasan mikvaydai lebasar v'dam is Rosh HaTevis Shalom. Peace. Maybe because the job of the Malchei Umos HaElam is to create peace, or maybe because it creates peace if we make this bracha over the Malchei Umos HaElam. You could understand it in one of two ways. That's a job, and it's important to make the bracha because it keeps the peace. But why do we make such a bracha on Malchei Umos HaElam? Shenasan mikvaydai lebasar v'dam. Kadosh Baruch Hu gave, bestowed his honor upon them. Why do we make such a bracha? Is it only to keep the peace? That wouldn't be a reason really to justify making a bracha. So Schwab explains the Mayim Beis HaShoeva in Sefer HaNechumish that it's because the Malchei Umos HaElam are themselves a manifestation, a puppet really, of the Ribono Shel Olam. HaKadosh Baruch Hu has a master plan for the world, and world events need to ultimately coincide with that plan. And the only way to orchestrate that is if HaKadosh Baruch Hu is controlling world events through the power structure of the Malchei Umos HaElam. So, Shenasa Mikvaydai Lebasar V'dam, we make a bracha because merely the power that's enjoyed by the king, even the Malchei Umos HaElam, not only the Malchei Yisrael, is a manifestation of the covet of the Ribono Shel Olam. It's a Medrash in Megillas Esther. The Medrash says, whenever Megillas Esther says, Melech Achashverosh, that's referring to Achashverosh himself. Whenever it says Melech, without Achashverosh, that's referring to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And the Gil says Hashem's name isn't found, but it's hidden behind. I don't see Astir, Astir. Hashem is hiding, he's lurking somewhere behind in the story of Megillas Esther. So Chazal are looking for you know, maybe a window to see the Yad Hashem. So perhaps it's in the word Melech. Melech refers to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's somewhere there in the story. So Schwab asks, how could it be the same word that refers to Achashverosh, Melech Achashverosh, refers to HaKadosh Baruch Hu? How can we compare the two with the same word, with the same description? He says, no, that's exactly the point. The point is that the Melech Achashverosh only was Zeicha and only operated in his Malchus because the Kadosh Baruch Hu, you know, he put him there. He was a puppet of the Ribbono Shel Olam. That's why he says we refer to Malchay, to the Kadosh Baruch Hu as Melech Malchay Hamlochim. Kadosh Baruch Hu is the king. How can we even compare Kadosh Baruch Hu to other kings? He's the king of kings. The answer is because all the kings are the emissaries, or the messengers of the Ribbono Shel Olam to fulfill his plan that he has for the world. And Kadosh Baruch Hu is sitting on top. You know, he's the puppet master, the puppeteer. He's sitting on top, pulling the strings. He's the Melech Malchay Hamlochim. But really, all of the Malachim are a manifestation of the Ribbono Shel Olam. The Ramban in last week's parasha says the same thing. Because although he's trying to struggle, how could it be, like the first five Makkos, as we all know, Paro hardened his own heart. He refused to send the Jewish people because he himself was obstinate and stubborn, refused to see what was in front of his eyes. The last five Makkos, Chazak Hashem is like Paro. Kadosh Baruch Hu hardened Paro's heart. And the Rishonim, Rambam, and all the philosophical Rishonim, the Rashma Rishonim, are bothered. How could it be if Kadosh Baruch Hu suspended the Bechira of Paroi and then punished him as a result? If Schar V'Yoynish is a result of our decisions, you get punished or rewarded based on your decisions. How could it be Paro here lost his ability to make decisions, and yet he was continued to be punished? How could it be? So Rambam has his landmark explanation, where the Rambam writes in his Tshuva, that it's because Bechira Chafshish, free choice, is a privilege. It's a gift the Ribbono Shel Olam gives us. And a person, if he abuses that at a certain degree, if you sin so excessively, Kadosh Baruch Hu could suspend your Bechira. You lost the gift. You lost the privilege of having free choice. And that's what happened here to Paroi. The Ramban has a different explanation, Sparno 2, that is because the miracles became so overwhelming. We only have free choice because Hashem is hidden somewhere in nature, right? If Kadosh Baruch Hu would be obvious, you know, there'd be miracles taking place all around us, we wouldn't have Bechira. Hashem's presence would be unavoidable, undeniable. Be no room for Bechira at all. So Hashem has to kind of conceal himself. The more Kadosh Baruch Hu is visible, the more Bechira becomes limited. So what happened after the first five Makkos was Kadosh Baruch Hu's presence was so obvious, in order to level the playing field, to restore Paro's Bechira, Kadosh Baruch Hu had to harden his heart to not see the obvious miracles that were taking place in front of him, which would have only, you know, forced his hand to release the Jewish people, which wouldn't have been fair. So in order to level the playing field, Shem had to harden his heart. However, then the Ramban has a third answer, which usually goes underneath the radar because he kind of mentions it as a throwaway line at the end. But I think it's significant. The Ramban at the end there says, no, maybe it's because the Pasuk didn't say for Mishle of Lev Melech Biyad Hashem, because the heart of the king is in the hand of Hashem. What that means is that the king sometimes does forfeit his Bechira. He's not the same as a private citizen, because the king is, we have Bechira Chafshis, private citizens have Bechira Chafshis, and Hashem rewards us or punishes us based on our decisions, because we don't necessarily have to affect the grand plan that Ribbono Shel Olam has for the world. But the kings are the players on the chessboard of the grand plan. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu does manipulate them to a greater degree than he does, you know, private individuals. That's not a suspension of Bechira, because that doesn't do that with them as individuals, but them as pawns, as, you know, pieces on the bigger board that Kadosh Baruch Hu has planned for the world. So it's not surprising, therefore, that because kings, Malchei Umos HaOlam, are Lev Melech Biyad Hashem, they're players on a Kadosh Baruch Hu's chessboard, and Kadosh Baruch Hu bestows upon them Shenasu Mikvay, the Levos of Adam, that they should enjoy certain privileges of the king that are similar to the Malchei Yisrael. And one of those privileges, perhaps, is the Dina de Malchus Adina. So that's one approach that you find within the Rishonim. Dina de Malchus Adina is because, which is the source for paying taxes, according to the Gemara Masechta Nedarim, is because the Malchei Umos HaOlam, as well as Malchei Yisrael, enjoy certain privileges. We who choose to live in their lands, or even if it was by default, have accepted upon ourselves their rulership, and along with that comes that they have the not only the right, but the responsibility as part of the mitzvah dinim to impose rules and obligations, and then to enforce those rules and obligations. Included within that is perhaps taxes. The Ran, Masechtas Nedarim, quotes from Tosfos as an entirely different approach. That it's not because of the Parshas HaMelech and something we accepted upon ourselves, a kind of Lockean idea, you know, that we accepted it upon ourselves, and you know, it's a mitzvah dinim and creating a just society. It's much more simple, and much more linear. And that is, all the properties in the kingdom belong to the king. He has the right to confiscate them, whatever. So if we want to live there, you have to pay rent. So the taxes are really just rent for living on the lands that belong to the monarch. And that fit within, you know, I think, the traditional way that a monarchy functioned, is that they owned like a feudal state. If you wanted to live there, you had to kind of want to be a landowner or whatever. It was only at the discretion of the king, and he therefore had the right to levy taxes as a kind of form of rent. Therefore, the Ran writes in the name of Tosfos something which is paradoxical, or ironic, that therefore Din HaMalchus HaDinah only applies in Chutz La'aretz. It does not apply in Eretz Yisrael, because Eretz Yisrael does not belong to any king. Eretz Yisrael was given to all of Klal Yisrael equally when it was divided amongst the Shvatim. So there is no rent that one can speak of to some overlord in Eretz Yisrael, because in Eretz Yisrael, HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave it to all the Jewish people equally. So ironically, Din HaMalchus HaDinah, according to Tosfos, only applies in Chutz La'aretz, does not apply in Eretz Yisrael. And there are some Poskim, they call the name of Chazanish and others, they adopted this position of Tosfos, and that there is a greater traction for Din HaMalchus HaDinah and Chutz La'aretz than there is in Eretz Yisrael. It's an interesting approach that Tosfos has, however, it doesn't seem to be accepted b'maisa. In the Shulchan Aruch, and that's where Bar Yashiv and Shlomo Zalman all disagree with those who adopt the opinion of Tosfos, and the name, the Ran calls the name of Tosfos, because in Shulchan Aruch it says, all these halachas are discussed in Chayshim Mishpat, Shin Samach Tet. It's all one simon. So that one simon, Shin Samach Tet, the Shulchan Aruch that puts in the Rambam, the approach that we said earlier, that no, that's not what Din HaMalchus HaDinah is. It's not based on you're paying rent to some overlord who really owns all the properties. It's because of the Parshas HaMelech, and by living there, you're accepting upon yourself the rule and order which they are obligated to create. And therefore, it says in Shulchan Aruch that the obligation to pay taxes applies Bein B'malchi Yisrael, Bein B'malchi Yisraelam. But it applies to Malka Yisrael too, a Jewish king. It's not describing a Jewish king in Chutz La'aretz. It's probably describing a Jewish king in Eretz Yisrael. And so it says already in Shulchan Aruch, seems to Paskin, not like the Rambam, not like the Ran in the name of Tosfos, that it's based on a kind of a rental arrangement, and therefore it should only be Chutz La'aretz, not in Eretz Yisrael. Even being Chutz La'aretz, and we don't distinguish between Malka Yisrael, Malka Umas Olam. It could be that this Machlekes, though, Harishonim, is important in understanding the extent of Din HaMalchus HaDinah. Because in the Shulchan Aruch, the Ramah quotes two opinions. How far do you take Din HaMalchus HaDinah? So one opinion of the Ramah is it only goes as far as property tax, as it relates to karka, property tax, not other forms of taxation. And then the Ramah quotes another opinion that b'chol davar, with regards to all matters, we apply Din HaMalchus HaDinah, all matters. Even according to the Ramah, that says it's all matters, we apply Din HaMalchus HaDinah. The Ramah later on qualifies, and he limits it somewhat. It's not all matters. But obviously, if there would be a law to violate Shabbos, we wouldn't apply Din HaMalchus HaDinah there, or a law that you must charge ribbis, right? You know, to Jews without a heter iska, we would never apply such a rule. But the Ramah later on qualifies that it's only if it's the Hanos HaMelech or Hakonas B'nei HaMedina, either one. Either it benefits the government or it benefits society, so then we would apply Din HaMalchus HaDinah. Beyond that, no one would say apply Din HaMalchus HaDinah, but it's beyond property tax, right? One opinion, the Ramah, is it's limited to property tax. The other opinion is b'chol davar. B'chol davar meaning anything that's l'hanoas ha-melech, for the benefit of the king, or takonas b'nei ha-medina. That's our Ramah, is a tshuva. How should we treat bankruptcy in halacha? Which is a very sensitive topic, if you've ever been involved in a kind of a bankruptcy dispute, because you borrow money, person borrows money, and he does not paying it back. So in halacha, we have no mechanism. There's a lot of people who have aimly, they simply don't have the money to pay back, which is nothing you can do with such a taina. That's the best taina in court, is aimly. you just don't have the money. What are we going to do? But bankruptcy of leaving obligations because a person doesn't have the assets, that we don't have a mechanism like that in halacha. However, of course, as we all know, there exists personal bankruptcy in American law, and there's a corporate bankruptcy. I don't know the difference chapters and all that, but there is a difference between corporate bankruptcy and personal bankruptcy. Certainly exists, and it's a way of providing relief for businesses from debt in order to enable them to emerge from the debt to come back and do business, which is good for society, right? If people would be worried, if there would be no bankruptcy, you would never be able to take take any risk in business, and reward is typically embedded in risk. So no one would ever create anything that would benefit all of society if they knew that if it failed, they would have to, they'd be stuck indefinitely paying out, indentured loans. So that's why they created bankruptcies, the Takanas B'nai HaMedina. So therefore, Ramosha is a Chubin, Nigras Moshe, based on this Ramah, that we should accept the laws of bankruptcy, at least certainly as it applies to corporate loans and business loans. We should accept bankruptcy in Halacha, perhaps even if it's between two Jews. Now, obviously, between a Jew and a Ben Noach, it would apply. But even if it's between two Jews, because that's a takana, not only because people probably have that in mind when you take out a business loan in America, unless you say we're going to operate based on Dina Yisrael, most people have that in mind. And things that are assumed in the business world, we should probably assume in the Jewish business world as well. It's known as minik ha-soichrim. Everyone does it that way, should apply to halacha too. But here, the establishment of bankruptcy was with takanas b'nei ha-medina. It's good for the people. It's good for society and for business, and therefore perhaps has traction in halacha too. Not everyone agrees, but that's it seems to be a legitimate. Many people do follow this perspective. However, just getting back, you have two perspectives we had over here in the Ramah. How far do you take dina malchus dina? Is it only property tax, or is it anything that it benefits the king or benefits society? So Rav Asher Weiss in his Chuvas Min Chasal should suggest that this perhaps depends on this machlokes rishonim that we started with. How do you understand din machlokes adina? Din machlokes adina is rent. I mean, not to be Rav Asher Weiss to connect the dots here, but if din machlokes adina is is because you're paying rent to the overlord or to the monarch who owns all of the properties, and we understand why it's limited to property tax. But if din machlokes adina is because of the obligations that Umas Ha'ilam have, but I know I have, of establishing a socially, just society that requires the rules and requires order, requires, enforcing those rules and obligations. Well, then we understand why perhaps it applies beyond property tax and perhaps b'chol davar to all, monetary issues that are l'hanos ha'melech u'tekanos b'nei ha'medina. How far do you take this, though? What does it mean, b'chol davar? Is it only in the area of dinei mamonos? Or is it perhaps, limited to the area of Dinei Mamonos? So that's a suffix Rav Asher has. And that's true in the Min Chasash about Dinei Malchus Adina. Do you take it further than, for example, what about jaywalking? Is that a violation of Dinei Malchus Adina or speeding going above 55 miles an hour or littering? All these violations of Dinei Malchus Adina. So he starts out with a suffix about that. But the truth of the matter is, there's a truth in Ramosha, Nikos Moshe, about cheating on the regents. This was a big thing, and for those of us who remember, when it was on the cover of the newspapers, and they stole the regents' answers. So in 1980, Rav Moshe has a tshuva, Nigros Moshe, about that they said in yeshivas is permitted to steal the regents' answers, and Rav Moshe was asked about it, whether or not that's true. So Rav Moshe says, of course, they're coming, they're just trying to be malshin to bring down the yeshivas, the holiness of the yeshivas. But then Rav Moshe addresses the issue itself, and Rav Moshe says, forget about Gnevas Das, that it's fraud, because a person's going to apply to college, or I don't know, maybe she was applying to college, but he's going to apply to college, or he's certainly going to apply for a job, and they're going to assume when he has a Regents diploma that he actually passed the Regents exam, and that his grades, something that was earned, and it's kind of meritocracy. So forget about the fraud issues, which certainly exist, the kind of Gnevas Das. Ramosha writes, one of the reasons why it would be prohibited, why it would be wrong, is because of Dina de Malchus Adina. Yeah, but Dina the Malchus Adina, because it's prohibited, right, to steal the answers to the standardized Regents exam. So, but that's not monetary issues. There is a fine probably, I don't know, but I assume there was a fine associated with it. But that's not, it's not a monetary regulation, a law. It's because society feels that it's wrong. And nonetheless, Rav Moshe applied Dina the Malchus Adina in that setting, too. Certainly that's the Takanas B'nei HaMedina. Society benefits from having meritocracy and honest, exams. So something that does benefit, all of us, but it's not a monetary law per se, and yet Rav Moshe continued to apply Dina, the Malchus Adina there. So Rav Asher concludes...
scholarship attached to your scores on the region,
Yeah, of course. Oh, that's also a fraud, for sure.
We have a monetary issue then.
Yeah, but I don't know if that's the motivation. Why, if I would, you know, be a trust fund person, or I would say, you know, I vow never to go into business. I think still don't think they would.
No, but in other words, if the scholarship is, let's say, given to the top 10,000.
Correct, but I don't think that's why.
And you cheated, then you're cheating somebody else.
I don't think that's why they legislated that you're not allowed to steal answers to an exam.
But there was a monetary.
Yeah, and that's where Moshe I think is going with the Gnei Vasas, that you're going to misrepresent your scores and you're going to get financial benefits in the end. But I don't think it's a financial law per se. It's not, you know, governed by the SEC, probably. You know, that's what I mean by that. But Rav Asher thinks that this issue should depend on, again, how you define Dina Malchus HaDina. What is the impulse with Dina Malchus HaDina? If it's because of kind of a rental arrangement, so then, of course, it has no would have no application outside of, you know, monetary issues. However, if it's a broader kind of idea of establishing a society with rules and obligations, we can begin to understand why it should apply beyond. However, Rav Asher does make, this is so great, this you have to be Rav Asher wise to say, but it's so typical if you know him, but I know he's been here many times, so I assume many people here do, but he says, we should never make the mistake, though, of treating the Dina Malchus HaDina, which does, of course, you know, is a valid and should be followed, as Malacha, with the mitzvahs of the Torah themselves, in this regard. Meaning, the mitzvahs of the Torah have to be followed regardless of whether the reason applies or most people follow the halacha, most people don't. You still have to do, you know, you're still supposed to do what's right. When it comes to Dina Malchus HaDina, which was motivated by some social benefit that's created as a result, then if the social benefit doesn't exist in this setting, you know, one doesn't necessarily have to follow the Dina Malchus HaDina with regards to, not with regards to taxes, but with regards to jaywalking, right? It's at 2 a.m. So if you're going to say jaywalking is governed by Dina de Malchus HaDina, so then what, you can't cross the street in the middle of the, you know, you have to go to the crosswalk on your own block at 2 a.m. when you're crossing the street, then cross at the crosswalk, because otherwise it's really illegal to cross. I know even over here, they give tickets for jaywalking on some of the streets around here. So would that be illegal at 2 a.m. when no one else is on the street? So most of us wouldn't run a red light, even, I was speaking for myself, wouldn't run a red light at 2 a.m, even when no one else is around, because it's just dangerous to do it, I think. But you know, jaywalking, I would do it at 2 p.m, but people do it at 2 a.m. Is that Dina de Malchus HaDina, really? It's hard to say. So Rav Asher says, don't confuse it with Dinam of the Torah. Dina Malchus HaDina, of course, needs to be followed. It's a very serious issue. It's not the same. It's motivated by a social benefit. If that social benefit doesn't make any sense at 2 a.m. when you're all alone in your suburban town, you know, it wouldn't, or for that matter, it only is to the degree to which it's enforced. To drive 56 miles an hour is not a religious imperative necessarily, a religious prohibition of Dina de Malchus HaDina. Because everyone knows that the, you know, police officers don't enforce a few miles over the speed limit. You know, different places, different standards. So it's not a violation. You could argue it's dangerous and there's a reason why they made 55 miles an hour. If you feel that way, you know, call it kavod. But to call it a Dina de Malchus HaDina when it's not enforced kind of universally across the board, they thought that was, you know, that's too far. 65, okay, maybe that's an issue of Dina de Malchus HaDina, but, you know, in, within that range of where it's not enforced, he didn't think that was a Dina de Malchus HaDina issue. He was discussing there, which is a fascinating issue, is building sukkahs without a building permit. Probably, if you would ask the municipality, we're building a structure in our backyard, do we need a permit? You probably wouldn't need a permit. I mean, it's like a shed. I know you need a permit to build a shed, so maybe you should need a permit, Dina de Malchus HaDina, to build a sukkah. So Rav Asher said that you don't need a permit to build a sukkah. Because in Eretz Yisrael, I think this year they took down one sukkah because it was, you saw this in the news. They were building in Yerushalayim right in the middle of town. It was like a 4-story sukkah. And the Israeli government enforced the law and they made it take it down. But typically, they don't demand permits. No municipality ever enforced that we should require building permits for a sukkah, even though on the books, it probably exists, right? There are a lot of obsolete laws on the books. We're not discussing that. But there, you know, certainly even building permits, which are typically enforced with regards to sukkah, they never enforce it. So then, al pi dina de Malchus HaDina, either, you know, one wouldn't necessarily be obligated to obtain a permit for that either. But it seems to be that we conclude, which seems to be the prevailing opinion within the Rishonim, that dina de Malchus HaDina is motivated not by a kind of rental arrangement and limited to property tax, but applies, in a more broader sense. Because of the dinim of the melech, that he's, you know, that even Malchut Umos HaOlam and even, you know, governments, not necessarily a formal melech, are obligated to establish rules of society to create a just society, and therefore one will be obligated to pay those taxes. What about, you know, avoiding to pay them? So it says in Shulchan Aruch, in the name of the Rishayim, that that should be a problem of Gzeiros Achim. So Gemara says in Bava Kamma, of course, one is not allowed to steal, not only from Jews, but from non-Jews as well. The Gemara does say in that context, in Bava Kamma and elsewhere, that Hafkaz Hava Asai Tol Sakum or Avedos Sakum are permitted. That means, Hafkaz Hava also means evading an obligation. Tol Sakum means if there's a mistake that was made, not correcting the mistake, or Aveda, something that was lost, and not returning it. So Mara says there, those obligations don't extend to Tal Sakum, Aveda Sakum, Hafkaz Hava Asoi are permitted, and that is quoted in Shulchan Aruch. That is quoted in Shulchan Aruch, that halacha. Rashi, the Rosh, the Ran, many Rishonim assume that that applies to taxes as well, that are issued by government. Those same laws of Ta'us Hakum, Avedas Hakum, Hafkas Hava'asoi would apply there as well. The Rambam, other Rishonim too, feel no. That's if you're dealing with an individual scenario or incident or individual. But the obligations that are posed by Dina the Malchus Adina are something that everyone is obligated to do and would not be treated with those same exclusions. And therefore the Rambam writes, Hafkaz Hava also, when it comes to Dina the Malchus Adina, just evading the obligation is itself tantamount, is the equivalent of Gneva Sakum and Zela Sakum, and of course would be prohibited. And the opinion of the Rambam is quoted in Shulchan Aruch, that evading these obligations is also considered to be Gzela Sakum. It is true that the Ramah does quote the other opinion in Rishayim, the Rashi, the Rosh, the Ran, that they treat obligations that are imposed, you know, by the government, the same as Hafkas Havasoi, as Gzeilos Akum, as Akum, as Avedos Akum, and you know those are not the same as stealing. The Ramah does quote that opinion. However, the Ramah does conclude with something that is not a throwaway, something that is critical. The Ramah says, with regards to all of these halachas that we know, evading an obligation, not returning a lost object, or correcting a mistake. All of those things are permitted in the absence of the potential for a Chilul Hashem, or in the absence of the potential for creating a Kiddush Hashem. But if there's a Kiddush Hashem that can be achieved by returning the lost object, by correcting the mistake, by paying the obligation, and certainly if there's a Chilul Hashem that can be created by evading the obligation, or by failing to correct the mistake, or failing to return the lost object, then the Rambam says, of course, a person is absolutely obligated to pay. So it seems by Ikar Adin, the Rambam Paskins, that this is tantamount to Gzeila Sakum, you know, evading tax is not the same as Hafkas Hava also in other settings. And the Ramah, of course, even though he quotes the lenient view, does caution that if there's a potential for, and I don't think we have to say there's a potential for Chilul Hashem, we all know there has been, we have achieved Chilul Hashem in this area. This is not a potential, this is something that is real, tangible, and something we suffer from. So the potential, you know, for Chilul Hashem certainly exists, and we should focus on the potential for achieving a Kiddush Hashem in this area. There's a book called The Ethical Imperative, which discusses many issues in ethics and halacha. So the first chapter is about this issue, and it quotes there from Rabbi Schwab, that once Rabbi Schwab, who of course was the head of, mentioned him earlier, so he was audited by the IRS, which is hard to believe, because what red flag did he trigger? You know, you don't make it, the IRS doesn't waste their time, typically, on Rabbanim, not at the highest of their... don't achieve that much. So they audited Rav Schwab because he was giving. They never saw someone who was making that little money give so much to tzedakah that they didn't believe it. So they came and they audited him. And at the end of the conversation, they got the KJ lawyers. The team was all there. So one of the lawyers said that at the end of the audit, the IRS man said he has never seen someone keep such meticulous records. Forget about the charity that he gave. Such meticulous records of every single penny and where it went, and made sure to, you know, cross his T's and dot his I's. So Schwab said, he explained at the end, they said, well, so careful about this. He said he wanted to be a Lechatzigo Jew. He didn't want to be, you know, a Bidiyevi Jew. So I think it's important, right? And then again, Rav Asher Weiss's statement is critical. Minimizing taxes, right? So structuring your business to pay the least amount of taxes and taking advantage of tax benefits and charitable donations, that's certainly permitted and every business, right, has a fiduciary responsibility to do so. And individuals also have the right to enjoy and to maximize the tax, you know, code to their benefit. But evading taxes, you know, certainly is something that we should avoid. And it's the proper to follow Rav Schwab's approach, to be a Lechachilu Jew in this area and not to be a Bidiyevi Jew. Rav Shechter, though, takes taxes as an original take, which I found echoes in elsewhere, that perhaps takes taxes in an entirely different direction. Rav Shechter argues that one would be obligated to pay taxes, not necessarily only because of Dina the Malchus of Dina, that might have been true in previous times, but now one is obligated to pay taxes for a different reason. The Gemara says in Baba Basra that if you have in a democratically elected society or government, that whenever you're dealing with a community, so Kaifin is Bnei Ha'ir, the Gemara says in Baba Basra, you can force the people in the city to pay for certain benefits that everyone in the city enjoys. For example, we can compel people to pay for a wall around the city for protection or for doors and locks or for other benefits that the city, you know, for other services that the city provides. You can compel everyone in the city to pay for them because everyone in the city enjoys those services. And therefore, even if a minority person said, you know, a minority in the city says, no, we don't want this service, as long as the majority of the people in the city want the service, so then they can compel, kind of like an assessment in a co-op or a condo, they can compel the other members within the community to pay for the benefits that they're all enjoying. And the Rama, when he quotes this halacha, writes, it depends on roiv. Whatever the roiv of the people through, you know, kind of elections, I guess, through whatever they decided as a group they're going to do, so that applies and is incumbent upon all the members of the group who enjoy these benefits and privileges, even if they didn't want them. Here we follow the rule of the majority. Sometimes you even follow the rule of the minority. For example, let's say in these kinds of cooperative arrangements, for example, let's say you have a community that the majority of the people don't want to build a shul, or the majority of the people don't feel they need a mikvah. So then the Rama writes that there, even if there's a minority of people who want a shul, there's a minority of people who want a mikvah, there's a minority of people who want to say for Torah, the minority can compel the majority to build a shul, to build a mikvah. And if therefore the community is building a mikvah, they can assess a communal tax, you know, an obligation on everyone in the community to pay for the mikvah, even if the majority of the people, you know, don't want it. Same is true with the school. Even if the majority of the people in the town don't use the school or don't plan on using the school, it doesn't matter. Part of the Jewish, you know, community needs to have a school. So then that, you know, that can be assessed on everyone in the community equally. Ramesh is an interesting tshuva about Muncie, because it was one, it's quite large. There was one mikvah already in the community on one side of the community. And they wanted to build a mikvah. It was too far to walk from the other side. So Marisha said, they go on Muncie Shabbos, they'd have to drive there. So Marisha was asked, can they compel everyone in the community to build a second mikvah on the other side of town? That Ramosha says, no, that's a majority, because some people might feel they can walk. Some people feel it's not a nuisance to go on Muncie Shabbos. Okay, that's different. But generally, if it's an obligation, Allah is on your side, you can compel the majority. Where does this come from? This is a Mishnah in Peah. It's fascinating, particularly this time of the year, winter and COVID and all this. Why? Because the Mishnah says in Masechta Peah, typically, payoff was the corner of the field was left by the farmer, and the poor people would come and collect. As the apostle says in Emor, you should leave it for them, and they'll come and collect it. However, and that's what normally was done. The farmer would not collect, the owner of the field would not harvest it and then distribute it to the Anim and Pekwach. He would let people come to the corner of the field and collect them themselves. However, if the field were the fruits or the vegetables were high up or in a dangerous place, then the Mishnah says the farmer has an obligation to gather it and to distribute it to the poor people as they come. So that's what is supposed to be done. So the Mishnah there says, if let's say everyone comes and it's not dangerous, but everyone would prefer the farmer, you gather it up for us, and we'll just take it in handouts. We'd rather not gather it ourselves. One guy says, no, I'll gather it myself. So then we follow him, because Allah is on his side. Typically what should be done is everyone should gather it themselves. Even if the 99% of the Aniyim say we'd rather you collect it for us and distribute it to us, he has the right to carry the day because Halacha is on his side. We're supposed to leave it for him and they're supposed to collect it themselves. And same in the other direction. If it's high up in a dangerous place, where right, if all the Aniyim are going to start climbing trees, someone's going to get hurt. So the farmer there, typically the Halacha is, the farmer should bring it down and distribute it to the Aniyim and Peklach. If all the Aniyim say, no, we're happy climbing the trees, leave it, so we'll go ourselves. One guy says, no, I'd rather you bring it down for me. We follow what that one guy says, because the halacha is on his side. So whenever the halacha kamoisa, the halacha follows you. You want a shul, you want a mikvah, or you want the payah to be distributed, you know, as the halacha should be, you have the right to compel the majority, even though the majority is against you. So Chaim Kanievsky has a sefer, a Maseches Peah, called Shari Amuna. So in that sefer, he quotes from Yisrael Salanter that this is the basis for the halacha that a lot of people know about. That if one guy in the winter, right? In the winter, typically the windows are closed. In the summer, typically the windows were open, at least prior to air conditioning. Now the windows are always closed. So I don't know how this halacha applies anymore, but the windows are never open. But at least traditionally, in the winter, the windows were closed. In the summer, the windows were open. So in the winter, even if everyone in the room wants the windows open, opposite of what they should have been. If one guy wants it closed, because he's cold, so he has the right to demand that everyone close the window. And by the same token, in the summer, if everyone wants the window closed, but one guy wants it open, so we have he carries the day. So Salanta said it's based on this Mishnah. So Chaim Kanievsky disagrees. He says, it's not based on Mishnah at all. The halacha is on that guy's side. There's no halacha that the window has to be closed in the winter and open in the summer. It might have been the convention, because whatever. Ventilation, it came up during COVID because a lot of times people wanted to ventilate the room, at least last year, people wanted to ventilate the room to clear the room from germs. And so everyone was fighting about, who gets to decide how cold it is and all these different things. But Reb Chaim Kanievsky, there's no halacha the windows to be closed, halacha the windows to be open in the summer. So the halacha isn't necessarily on your side. He thinks it should be ruled by the majority, governed by the majority. We shouldn't go based on what one individual thinks in one direction or the other. But if the halacha is on your side, obviously one person can compel the majority. But typically, whenever you have a group that's all living together and they all enjoying services and the majority of them want this service, so then that obligation devolves. That obligation ultimately descends upon all of the members of that group who are enjoying that service. So therefore, Schechter argues quite convincingly, I think, that nowadays our taxes are all used for social services that we all benefit from. Whether we choose to avail ourselves of that services, whether we agree that the tax money should be allocated in that fashion, it doesn't matter. We're all part of a majority, and whatever the majority decided, that is incumbent upon all of us to pay. And if a person doesn't pay, he's inevitably causing the group or other individuals to have to pick up the bill at some point, if not now, at some point later on in the future. So we'll be obligated to forget about the whole discussion of Dina Malchus Adina and all the different details we discussed within that part of the conversation. The very fact that this goes to pay for social services that we all enjoy, and the majority decided to allocate their money this way, so that obligation should extend to us as well. Just one final concluding comment, which I think is important in this area, and to keep in mind, which is a kind of echoing of what Schwab was trying to convey in the manner in which he conducted himself. Actions always speak louder than words, and the fact that he conducted himself in this way is a powerful example. But even last week's parasha, Paro gives Moshe Rabbeinu, the Jewish people, the liberty, says, after Makas Arav, go bring all your karbonis, get it out of your system, go do whatever you want, leave me alone. And Moshe Rabbeinu says, no, we're not going to do that. Go inochon. He says, it's not right. Go inochon. We're not going to go. Inochon lasos kain. We're not going to go and shecht your animals outside of the community, because how could it be we're going to shecht the gods of the Egyptian? They worship these livestock. Lo yiskalunu. And they're not going to stone us. How could it be? So Sam Sefer says, what do you mean, how could it be? You just successfully orchestrated four makas. Paro is on his knees. He gave you permission to go and sacrifice his God outside of the community and leave me alone. What do you mean, lo nachon? It's not right, because they might get angry and come to stone us. So Sam Sefer says, no, Moshe Rabbeinu was not afraid of the consequences that Paro, could threaten him. At this point, they were pretty confident. It wasn't because of that. It was Moshe Rabbeinu was conveying to Jewish people, it's just not right to do it. They have a sensitivity to this issue, and it's not right to trample on their sensitivity. But beyond the issue in terms of being sensitive to other people's sensitivities and careful, to cater to them, beyond the sensitivity issue, what Moshe Rabbeinu here is teaching us is that there's more to life than just following the rules, and there's a bigger picture here about what's nachon lasos ken, what's lo nachon lasos ken. And even if one could fetch in one thing or another, we have to always bear in mind that advice of Moshe Rabbeinu, lo yinochon lasos kein, that sometimes there are certain things that create the chil Hashem, and our obligation to create a kiddush Hashem, and that goes beyond, one person's meir heter. That has to be, we have to be careful about what is the right thing to do. Yerushalmi says in the name of Shimon ben Shetach, in the Perek Eul Mitzias, the second paragraph of Mitzia, where the Gemara says, Avedas Akum is permitted. You have to return the lost object of a Jew, lost object of an Akum does not need to be returned. Should only be returned if you're going to make a Kiddush Hashem. So the Gemara there, Yerushalmi tells the story that once Shimon ben Shetach, his business was in flax. and he was busy carrying the flax on his back all the time. So his Talmidim were upset that the Rebbe here was schlepping the flax. So they offered to buy him a donkey to carry the flax. So they bought him a donkey from the local Akum, Benoch. And the donkey came. They didn't realize it at the time, but the donkey had a jewel, a necklace that was stuck around his neck. Maybe that was the jewelry case. I don't know. But that's where they hung the jewels, around the neck of the donkey. So they came to Shimon ben Shetach with the donkey, and they saw the jewel that was hanging around his neck. They said, not only did we buy you the donkey to help alleviate your burden in doing your parnasa, you don't have to work now at all. Hack this, sell this diamond or whatever it was, and you don't have to work another day in your life. So Shimon Shetach said, where'd you get it from? They said, it was on the donkey that we bought from the Akum. He said, did the Akum know that the jewel was around the neck of the donkey? So he said, no, he didn't know about it. But it's Avedus Akum. So he says to them, he says, what do you think I am? Barbarian, Hava? You think, he says, Shimon ben Shetach is a barbarian? You think I'm going to take this? And I think what the lesson is, of course, Avedus Akum is permitted. He wasn't arguing on the Etzem Halacha. What he was arguing is that this is not the way that I conduct my business. Do you think I am a barbarian? So as we said, I think Be'ikra Adin, when it's obligated to pay taxes, it's prohibited to evade taxes for a whole number of reasons, as we've discussed. But even above and beyond that, it's important in this area in particular for Jews to go Lefnim Mishur Adin, to be a L'chachilu Jew, not to be a B'diyavid Jew. And Amir Hashem, by doing so, not Chas Shalom ever to create a Kiddush Hashem, but just the opposite, to create a Kiddush Hashem.
Yeah. Right. Oh, cats. That's perfect.